Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie, and one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter, from plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
In the dark, I played my dream. Burma goes and flows like sweet streams. I'm the daddy with the know-how feet. Creating the world like it's meant to be. Burma goes to B-I-L-D. I'm the king. Back it up in everything. Bring a change, making it last.
Welcome to episode 450 of the Permaculture Pimp Cast, where PIMP stands for Permaculture is my passion. The only PIMP cast on planet Earth where we discuss permaculture, preparedness, practical living, and sometimes prostitutes. Oh yeah, good to be here with y'all. Alrighty, this episode, as always, brought to you by the Sovereign Health Summit. That's going to be October 27th through the 31st. That's going to be in Harmony, North Carolina. TPC will get you 5% off. Hey, remember, our headliner is going to be Barbara O'Neill, but we got a whole other gang of people that's going to be along for the ride, y'all. So definitely be there, be square. Alrighty, also the wellness blanket, 10% off with promo code PERMA. Michelle is hugged up in that little whoobie every night, and it does work, folks. We even got another one for our bed, so you gotta love that. Billy, 100 will get you $100 off of that wave watch. If you notice, folks, I'm not kidding. Every single video I do, you see me wearing that thing. You want to know why? Oh, it might have something to do with the fact that it keeps me from going upside the heads of all these bullheaded marchies running around Asheville. So yeah, there's a reason why I wear that thing, because it keeps me cool as a cucumber, especially when I'm in the company of some people that I don't necessarily like. And then finally, Soil Saviors, you'll see a link for that down below. And was actually in a place today where we saw the product of Soil Saviors. All right, so check it out, y'all. I got Ryan Mata, who's going to be on with me probably in about 30 minutes or so. A little bit of, not of a scheduling conflict, but these things happen, man. Things are going to happen where people are out and about. They got to do something, or they got caught up with something. It happens, but I'm an old pro at this. So you always got a plan B, but don't worry. He's going to be on after a little while. Today, if you're watching live, you see my shirt. What does it say? Huh? Remember the Liberty. The USS Liberty, June 8th, 1967. What's that, 59 years ago? Yeah, this is what Thomas Massey, of course, nobody at Fox News or the prostitutes at CNN or MSNBC or whatever they call themselves these days, nobody's going to be talking about that. Nobody's ever going to cover that. But yeah, what happened? And honestly, when I scheduled Ryan Mata for this, it didn't even occur to me what the date would be. But I mean, I can't think of a better time to bring somebody on like him. And folks, I'm just telling you, just buckle up, because there ain't no telling where he might go and what he might say. But anyway, USS Liberty, there's a whole lot of people out there that have no idea what happened back then. So as I understand it, the USS Liberty was off the coast of Egypt. And of course, there was a war over there. And in an effort to get the US to, it was a false flag. It really was. So as I remember, there were French Mirage aircraft flying over. They flew over the day before, and then of the day of the attack, they flew over again, did something of a recon, and then they came in and strafed the USS Liberty. Hundreds injured. I mean, almost 70% of the crew, as I recall, was either injured or dead. Over 100 dead, I think. And they kept going back and forth and back and forth. Folks, if you haven't seen the documentary, Remember the Liberty, I think it was done by True News. It was a four-part series. I rented it. And I'll be honest with you, I never did finish the very last part of it. I was so freaking annoyed, I couldn't even finish it. couldn't even finish watching it. And I really need, in fact, maybe today I'll find the time. I doubt it, but maybe not today. But I really need to finish that last part because I remember being so aggravated of what happened. So they finally, you know, they're getting strafed left and right. And there is no doubt whether or not this is a U.S. ship. And there's no doubt whether or not it was the Israelis doing it. And that's who it was, trying to sink that ship to the bottom, but it wouldn't sink. No matter how many times they hit that thing with 30 millimeter cannons, they even dropped napalm on the deck. And it still didn't sink. That ship would not sink. Here's the cold-blooded part. I mean, there's a whole mess of it that's really cold-blooded. If you listen to the accounts of all the surviving members that are in that documentary, each one to a man had met with a general, knowing that, you know, anybody lower ranking, especially an enlisted person, you may go your whole career and never once see a general. That's entirely possible. So they get these guys in a room with this general, and the general basically tells them, if you speak or say anything about what happened, you will go away. You'll probably die the death penalty, or you'll go away in prison for the rest of your life. That's what they told these guys. And for years and years and years, all these people that did survive dealt with unbelievable guilt, as you can imagine, with all your shipmates dying like that, being murdered right there in front of you and knowing that there's absolutely nothing you could do about it. And then finally, years later, they decided, you know what, forget it. We're going to all speak out and we're going to do it. And they've been doing it for years and years and years. In fact, I buy every T-shirt they come up with at the USS Liberty Foundation, or I'm not sure if it's called Foundation. But anyway, I've been trying to blow the whistle on what had happened in this thing forever and a day. And folks, I'm here to tell you that polecat, Lyndon Johnson, not only was he probably almost certainly, if you believe Roger Stone's account and what he said of, you know, he's an insider. And if you can believe what he said, that even Nixon said, yeah, you know what? LBJ and I both wanted to be president, but LBJ didn't mind killing for it. And apparently he would become, you know, Nixon would become quite loquacious after a drink or two. And, you know, he spilled the beans supposedly to Roger Stone, telling him that, yeah, LBJ had did this. So, and here's the worst part about all this. Here's the absolute worst part. So the first thing the Israelis did when they came in and strafed this boat, they made sure they took out any ability for them to transmit anything. So they had guys running with portable means to transmit, and they're putting out, mayday, 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 we're being attacked. Here's what's happening. And all the ships, they got out. So all these ships in the area got that message. And what did they do? Just like any good soldier, sailor, airman, the commanders on those vessels sent out, you know, aircraft to go assist. And guess who called them back? The commanders of those ships actually got a call from Robert McNamara himself. If you don't know who he was a, I can't believe it escapes me right now. But anyway, Robert McNamara, he was also in the Kennedy administration, went over there to the Johnson administration. And, you know, he's personally calling all of these commanders saying, hey, turn these guys around by order of the president. And some stories are that LBJ himself actually got on the horn to some of these captains to get them to turn them around. And LBJ is quoted as having said, I want that GD boat on the bottom of the ocean. Yeah. That was the president of the United States. First time, I guess, before or since in the history of the United States that a ship put out a mayday was heard by other ships. I mean, there may be other cases that we don't know about, probably. Who knows? I mean, we live in a strange world these days. Anyway, the only time in modern history where a mayday was put out, they heard it and did absolutely, positively nothing. And then, of course, that... Here's when I say the hits keep coming. I mean, let's not forget about the fact that all of those, because this was a super secret NSA kind of vessel, because of its nature, they told all of these guys who had witnessed all these guys die that they had to sit there with the rotting corpses with all these men as it was towed back into some harbor. I can't remember where. And of course, you know, they were told to keep their lips sealed or they'd wind up in Davy Jones's locker. Yeah, that's your own government doing this, folks. And don't think I'm some hoople-headed marchy that's talking to, look, I'm a former soldier myself. So anybody that says, well, how can you speak? Look, keep that to yourself, man. I'm not even going to worry about it. I'm not even going to give a second thought about it. Bottom line is, this is your government at work. And that happened back in 1967. It's 59 years ago. And still no acknowledgement, no anything from the Israelis, and definitely no pressure by our own government to get them to apologize for what they were attempting to do, which was a false flag. Can't think of anything more timely than what's going on today. And then, you know, thank God for Thomas Massie getting up there and right there in Congress and telling the whole world what had just happened. All right. With that said, we're going to go here in a second. We're going to go to my man, Ryan Mata. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anyway, he's an independent journalist, documentary filmmaker, and a commentator known for his investigations into child trafficking, government policies, border issues, folks, you name it. Let me just tell you how he came on my radar a while back. Folks, as you know, as everybody in this audience knows, that we raised a lot of money for Caleb House. You know, they go out there, rescue all these kids caught up in child trafficking. We've raised a lot of money for Vets for Child Rescue. Being a vet, that's where I felt called to go at first. Anyway, when all this happened, we suffered a whole lot from the powers that shouldn't be. And Ryan first came on my radar because of his work there, but I had no idea that this guy had such a wide net and was doing a whole lot of work out there. So anyway, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show, Ryan. How you doing, my man? And how do you actually pronounce your last name? Uh-oh, you're muted, bro, I think on your end. Test. Guess you can hear me, but I can't hear you. Folks, we're having something of a technical difficulty. I don't know what's going on. It could be the fact that I have Ryan Mata on the show. Still hearing nothing. Anyway, bear with us, folks. I think he's going to come out and come back in. Anyway, folks, I wanted to bring Ryan on for a whole variety of reasons. I've been trying to reach out to this guy like nobody's business, and he was pretty difficult to find. Now, I'm going to warn you right up front. I don't know what he's going to say. that's part of what I love about the guy is that if you check out his X account, there's going to be a whole lot of people out there that ain't going to dig it, but I certainly do. All right, Ryan, I'm not hearing you. Looks like we're still having some kind of technical difficulty. Well, I think if I had to make a guess here, folks, I'm guessing maybe it might be the fact that it just happens to be June 8th. I heard something. I don't know what you did, bro. It might have something to do with the fact that it's June 8th. Here we are, the 59th anniversary of the USS Liberty. And they probably know we're about to get down and talk about some stuff here. So maybe the powers that shouldn't be don't necessarily want us connected here. So we'll just give it another second here. Well, can't have dead air. While Ryan's figuring this out, folks, I'm going to give you some other hacks that we got going on around here. Think about all those food scraps you have. What do you do with them? Do you throw them in the trash? Do you put them in the, what do you do with them? Well, okay, your compost pile is a good place for you thinking, okay, I only got this, I only got that. And by the way, Ryan's working on the technical end of his thing, and we'll see what happens. So anyway, folks, even your food scraps, it doesn't matter. Even your neighbor's food scraps, it doesn't matter. Put them in the freezer, put them in a Tupperware thing, put them in the freezer, do whatever you got to do with them. And this is one of Dr. Elaine Ingham's thing, is what she used to do as well, is she would take them, and then when she would get about, let's say, a 5-gallon bucket worth, then all of a sudden she would put it into the pile. That's another little hack out there too. Here's another thing. Keep your worms in close proximity to your pile. Now, there's a whole lot of people out there doing a different worm bin. I'm going to tell you the easiest way to do it. Take your finished compost and stick it into your worms. Let them work on that. You don't have to give them food scraps and stuff like that. In fact, depending on how you do it, that might be one of the quickest ways to have the whole thing go pretty anaerobic, meaning you're going to kill all your worms at the same time, folks.
About now, brother.
Okay, here he is. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go. Okay, I had to switch three different browsers. It didn't work on Brave. Brave was blocking my camera and my audio. Then I switched to Chrome. Couldn't get it running on Chrome. And then I jumped over to Safari and boom, it works. I'm like, I'm watching my board. I got a soundboard. I can see my audio levels. I know my mics are working. I'm like, what in the hell is going on? So two browsers are blocking us over here. Like you said.
Yeah, so Ryan, I'm not at all shocked. I started off the beginning of this program talking about, you know, when I booked you for this show, I had no idea the significant. Well, I knew about, you know, June 8th, 1967, when the USS Liberty was bombed. Remember the Liberty? I got the shirt on right now. And I was thinking, man, I can't think of having anybody better on this day. I didn't plan it this way. It just worked out. And it just happened to be at a time that was going to work out for both of us. So, Ryan, I'm glad you're here. Right off the bat, bro, you know, every superhero has an origin story. You're one to me and a whole lot of other people out there. Why don't you tell us what brought you to the space where you are right now?
Oh, man, Billy, man, such an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me, man. I'm a huge fan of the work that you guys are doing out there as well. So thanks for having me on the podcast, man. Sorry I was running late. That was completely my fault. Billy had me booked, everything scheduled out. And then last minute, me and my son were coming home. We just took my grandpa out to dinner. And he's like, Dad, can a friend come over? I'm like, yeah, I guess so. He's like, can we go pick him up? I'm like, all right, yeah, sure. Happened to be an extra 30 minutes out of the way, so it put us a little bit behind. That was my fault, so don't blame Billy for that one. But what got me in the space, man, was I was just a humble Bitcoiner. Honestly, I was just a guy that was, you know, working a 9-to-5 job. I pretty much partied during high school, didn't go to college at first, watched all my friends go to college. And then, you know, my friends started to come back from college. They started getting the better jobs. They had new cars. They were starting families. They had this thing that I didn't have. And I always thought it was just education in school that prevented me. It was the money that I wasn't making. And I wasn't making the money because I didn't have the education to make the money. Because that back when we kind of were younger, you had to go to college at least to come some up and get a decent job. We didn't really understand that skilled trades and the manufacturing industry was also an opportunity. So at first, I didn't go to school, didn't go to college. Then, you know, you're listening to Gary Vee and you're listening to all these other people, you know, and they're saying, go to school, get a good job, and then, you know, start a side hustle, start a side business. So I ended up getting a job at a factory that was and I knew that this factory would pay for my school. So I went back to work in the manufacturing industry. And then I worked my way up, became a controls engineer, went to school. They paid for my schooling. They paid for me to go to school. So I did all of the things. And I started at this factory at $10 an hour. And then granted, every time I got a raise, I tried to put a portion of it into my 401k, but I went from $10 an hour to $30 an hour over like a 6-year period. And my standard of living didn't change. Right. So in the process of doing that, I got it big into cryptocurrency. I was one of the first people on YouTube teaching you how to mine Ethereum and Bitcoin back in like 2015, not the first person on YouTube teaching you how to mine Bitcoin, but one of the first people on YouTube teaching you how to mine Ethereum was when it was like $2.60 a coin. Did that for a while, made a decent amount of money. Then we went into the bear market and kind of everybody fell out of crypto and I wasn't smart enough to stick with it and really ride it through. But in the time I took some money out of that and I started a clothing line and I built this because that was the time it was like I kept making more money at work, but I kept my standard of living didn't change. So I figured that, hey, I'm going to start a business. And then you listen to books like The 4-Hour Work Week where you have to start a business online and has to, you know, your goal isn't to work more to make more money. Your goal is to make more money working less. So that's when kind of Amazon and everybody was starting the Amazon businesses. I did that, built the second fastest growing EDM clothing line in America by 2019, 2020. And I ended up quitting my job as a controls engineer. I was designing clothes full time. And I got my company to the point where it was February of 2022 would have been the worst couple months of the year because that's winter for us in the EDM clothing line. Our season is summer and even into fall and some of spring. And worst months of the year, and we were doing $125,000 a month in sales. So it was like, finally, for the first time, I was going to actually get a paycheck and be able to pay myself. And I quit my job as a controls engineer, was doing that. And then COVID hits, right? And that was the first time. So I went from doing $125,000 a month in sales to negative $5,000 a month in sales. But in the process of this 3-year period, I met my girlfriend. She was an Instagram model. She modeled my clothing line for me, and she taught me how to generate money online from social media. So I saw that it was like, okay, I can go back to being a controls engineer. I could go and give this social media a shot. So I started doing the social media stuff for a little bit. And then it just wasn't enough. Like I wasn't this cute girl in a bikini that was going to magically gain hundreds of thousands of followers overnight. I was trying to teach people photography and whatnot. So quickly realized I needed to get two sources of income as well. So I went back to work as a controls engineer. And then one day at work, I was making YouTube videos and my buddy's like, hey man, he's like, you're really big into crypto and crypto's kind of booming again. Why don't you make a video on crypto and put it on your YouTube channel? I was like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Went home, made one video, and boom, it blew up. Made another, blew up. And then within 30 days, I was making more money on YouTube online than I was as a controls engineer. So I quickly kind of converted into doing Bitcoin and crypto podcasting. And I did that for a couple of years. And in the process of going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, you really realize how corrupt money is. Once you start realize that money is the foundation of all of this corruption, which is the central banks and God's chosen people, you quickly realize like that's where this everything started. But I was completely clueless to politics. In 2022, I didn't know what the Speaker of a House was. I knew what a vice president was, but you know, I was never big into elections. The last two I voted in, my girlfriend basically drug me to the polls and forced me to vote. So I didn't, and at one point in like 2021, if you would have came in my live streams talking about Trump or Biden, I would have just shut down my live stream or just kicked you guys out of my live stream because I didn't even want to hear politics. I didn't want to talk about it. Didn't think our votes mattered. I really had no clue. And then in 2022, sometime, I was still doing the crypto stuff full time, and the FTX collapse happened, and the big crypto exchange Sam Bankman-Fried collapsed, and then Tucker Carlson started talking about it, Trump started talking about it, so I started making shorts out of that, and those shorts started going mega viral. And next thing I know, I'm doing 30 million views a month across three YouTube channels by myself, and my channel was going crazy. I gained 100,000 followers in like 30 days. It was nuts. And then all of a sudden, one day I put out a video of Andrew Tate saying Bitcoin was a better investment than a house. And it wasn't even one day. I put the video out like months ago. And then one day I came and then boom, they demonetized my YouTube channel. Just so happened at that time, I was working for a company called LFATV. They invited me to CPAC and I had no idea about politics. And one of the girls called off on their show. So I filled in a spot shot, covered a show. And then at 6:45 p.m., and I can only just say that it's divine intervention. It was just God, right place, right time. He wanted me to make videos, I think, on child trafficking, because when the story plays out from here, it gets crazy because I don't know how else it could happen if it wasn't God's doing. And so at 6:45 p.m., I looked on my phone and it's blown up. All my YouTube subscribers that actually had my phone number were my friends were blowing up my phone. Hey, you canceled our memberships. You canceled our memberships. What's going on? And I instantly look at my phone, notification from YouTube, email, we demonetize your channel because you put out violent and dangerous content. And then I instantly go, oh shit, they're going to start hitting me for other videos that I had put out before. So it's instantly got on YouTube. It was like, I'm going to delete all my live streams and then I'm going to go appeal this, right? Well, after you get a violation, if you delete anything, you can't appeal it. So I didn't know it. So I basically rigged myself into not being even able to appeal my demonetization. Long story short, that was it. And I walk out of the doors at 7:15 from filming Trump, and the owner of LFATV offers me a job on LFATV. Asked me if I can start in a week. Ended up starting like 2 weeks. First week on the show comes a whistleblower named Carlos Arellano. And he tells me how our government's running the largest migrant child trafficking operation that the world has ever seen. And he's been partaking in it for the last 9 years. And he has all the details, all the receipts, where they're taking children. After 3 hours of interviewing this guy, he also got interviewed by Kyle Serafin, who's an FBI whistleblower, who I was also producing a show for at the time. So I was really good friends with Kyle. He was one of the lead interrogators inside the entire FBI. Like when the FBI wanted to stake out and hunt somebody down, they basically called up Kyle's crew. Kyle assembled and they just transcended on whatever city or town they staked out. And they would almost always get the guy. I think he actually got the guy every single time. And Kyle's just a master. This kid's probably one of the smartest dudes you ever read. He interviews Carlos and it's like, yeah, I think he's legit. And I'm like, okay. And then at the end of our interview, it was 3 hours. I'm like, he's like, you give me that face that everybody gives me. But I told three reporters this already, but you can come down to Texas and I can take you to these facilities. I'm like, wait, you can take me to a facility right now where there's kidnapped migrant children. They're being housed in these facilities that are funded with our tax dollars. And you can take me to the building. We can go in there and see the children. He goes, no, we can't go onto the property. He goes, they'll have security grabbing us before we even get onto the property or more than a few feet onto the property. He's like, but if we get there early, we can stake them out. And we can go hide in the fields or in this trailer park next to one. And we can get our drone. If you got drones, we can get drones out. And at 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. almost every day, like clockwork, is when they move the children. During the when it's still dark, almost dusk, because they're getting them on the first flights out in the airport before the airport even gets busy as they're trafficking all the children through it. So like clockwork, the buses start pulling in at 4:35 in the morning. And we got our drones up. The sun's just coming up. And you can see the caseworkers. They go door to door on these, I don't know, like shacks, these like, I don't know, like mini huts. And they start rounding up the kids and they take a line of kids. And then the bus pulls in and they got these like privacy fences. So like the fences with all like that black stuff on them, it's like woven in and out through like the chain links. And the buses pull in and you see them get the kids get put on this bus. And then that bus goes to the airport. We follow the buses to the airport and you see them, a line of kids getting off and they're walking through TSA. And then they have these manila folders and like the caseworkers and like these, they call them escorts, like walk these kids. and they go right around TSA, right through with, you know, like we're all waiting in the TSA line. They have like special lines for all the migrant children. They just process them right around this line. They don't go through any body scanners or nothing. And then they're just putting these children on flights and they're flying them all across our country. And then the person that's receiving them meets them at a baggage claim and then they hand the kid over. And that's normally the last time the kid's ever seen alive again. And that's the entire operation. I go way deeper into it, but that's kind of like the brisk of how I got just basically catapulted into this by God. And that led into 4 documentaries, now 5 documentaries on child trafficking. We got a 6th one coming. I've traveled the world, been to Malaysia, Thailand. Then that led me into Tanzania. And I took a 26-hour car ride into the jungles of Africa to figure out where these girls were getting recruited out of these jungles and by madams. And I got a whole bunch of crazy stories. We can go deep as you want, brother.
No, man, this is exactly what I wanted to reach out to you. I mean, I'm glad through a number of mechanisms that I was finally able to connect with you, because this is something we used to talk about a lot here in this show. And I, you know, before we go any further, because what I'm wondering with what we've done, I'm curious to know your experience, because here, when we started talking about child sex trafficking, satanic ritual abuse, and all the other things that are going on, all of a sudden we were being attacked in ways that most people would not understand. And what I'm talking about is, you know, obviously suppression of the YouTube channel, because we're mostly talking about farming and permaculture and things of that nature. But when we started talking about that, because it's so near and dear to my heart, all of a sudden we were being spiritually attacked. I didn't know at the time, but a guy named Nathan Reynolds told us that you could rent an entire gang of witches in Asheville, North Carolina, for about $500, and they'll put a hex on a brother, which is what they did. Of course, we ended up getting some, we got some spiritual help on that one. And there were other things going along, like electronic gang stalking. A lot of people don't know what that is, but that happened to us. So I got to ask, for a guy that's in the trenches like you, and folks, if you haven't seen Ryan's work, please, please go check out his documentaries, because they are absolutely, I was talking about the documentary where you can see the USS Liberty. It's called, what is it? Oh, it's a 4-part documentary, Remembering the Liberty or something like that. It's through True News. If you go to True News, you'll find it. Anyway, where I told you it was tough for me to finish that, well, it's tough to finish Ryan's as well, but I'm telling you, folks, you got to know about this. These kids are coming up, you know, missing like nobody's business. But Ryan, I got to ask before we move on, surely you have suffered some serious, if we've suffered what we have from talking about this stuff, what have you dealt with?
Man, mainly just the demonetization. I mean, I think I got into the game a little bit late. So like the attacks that they have, I got into Bitcoin early on. So I was never dependent on a real job. I've never worked, you know, where they could call my job and get me fired from a job. So I've kind of been in a position that I've been able to survive. I've been demonetized so many times. And like when I got demonetized, I got offered the job at LFA TV. So I was working for a network that was full on board with everything that we're talking about, right? Like they were encouraging me to go down these rabbit holes. So that just had allowed me. And then I transitioned into doing the films, right? And then the films became my main source of income. So I was actually self-funded from all of you guys, from the internet, you know? And then obviously getting 12 TikToks, I've lost 4 YouTubes demonetized, lost 3 Instagrams. I'm also permanently demonetized on all 3 Instagrams that I've lost. I think I have 2 of them left now, or they're like, I've got 2 up. So that would be like 4 and 5 that are still up and running. Facebook, I never really posted on Facebook until recently, until like the Charlie Kirk assassination, and on my Facebook's kind of blown up as well. And then, yeah, man, just lost. This is my 2nd or 3rd accident. I'm also permanently banned and permanently banned from LinkedIn. I can't even create an account because they got my IP addresses banned. So, yeah, that's kind of the main gist of it, man, but nothing too serious and crazy. I think I have a strategy that kind of keeps me alive. You know, I kind of keep my films under wraps until I just release them. And every day it's just like been one random day, and I just come out and I'm like, hey, got a new documentary coming, boom. Or I'll talk about it a little bit, but I'm not like, you know, a lot of these people put out trailers and then they advertise them for 6 months. And then that gives the government time probably to hack into your shit. They see what's in your documentary and they realize how damaging they're going to be. You know, like the Seth Riches and all of these people that have died and just, you know, randomly end up one day dead. Nancy Schaefer was getting ready to drop a mega documentary on CPS, and she ended up murder suicide. You know, her and her husband, they were an 80-year-old couple. She was a senator. She, you know, they had the dream life, 4 children, like 10 grandchildren. They are living happily ever after, no health issues. And then one day, you know, they find both of them in bed with holes in their chest. And allegedly the husband shot her in the chest and then turned around and turned the gun on himself and shot himself in the chest, which like nobody commits suicide with like a gun in the chest. Like it doesn't even make sense. Like, and then it was just case closed, nothing to see here. And her documentary never seen the light of day. And she was going to burn down the entire CPS child trafficking empire, which is, you know, our government's kidnapping roughly 480,000 American children legally through the CPS system. And then the ones that really need to be saved don't ever get saved, right? Like there's a lot of children that CPS gets called on, a lot of families that CPS just does nothing. But it's like they don't want these kids. It's like specifically specific types of children that, I don't know, garner higher dollars or are more sought after than others, or it's going after the white nuclear family. But, you know, CPS takes 480,000 children. And then according to an own audit that CPS did in 2019, where they went back and reviewed cases in the initial, like, did we have grounds to remove that child from that parent according to our, like, the own protocols and the laws that we're supposed to follow? 83.3% of the time they were in the wrong. So, and then 54% of the time when CPS checks a child, the parents never see that child again. And then it's like another, the 48% that do, it's like 90% of them don't see their children within the first year. So the damage that's done to a child, the damage that's done to a family, the second that CPS takes your child, I mean, imagine the government taking your child at force, and then they tell you that you can only see your child once a week or once a month and supervised visits. And then they cancel a few of those. So you go 2 or 3 months, while at the same time, you have to go to classes, a meeting, anger management, and maybe you haven't done anything, right? You just made the mistake of opening your door because you got a Karen that's your neighbor and you homeschooled your kid. And they decided to say, oh, hey, Johnny's in the backyard playing and it's new and I don't see him at school. I think CPS should come over here and take a look at these parents. I don't think they're good parents. And CPS shows up and you just happen to have a blue haired, you know, lesbian freak that's your caseworker. And you got a don't tread on me flag on your wall and you're instantly a Trump supporter, right? Or she sees a MAGA hat and doesn't like you, whatever the case may be. Once you open the door, most people think they're good parents, right? They think that they've done nothing wrong. I'm a great parent. I got nothing to hide. Yeah, come on in my house, right? And then she comes in and goes, oh, you got dishes in the sink. Oh, you got a brand new puppy. Oh, you just let your puppy pee. You're like, no, it's 6 months old, but you've been here for 30 minutes and I was supposed to let it out every 20 minutes and it just peed. That's neglect, right? And then she gets 5 or 6 things on her chart. Could be completely a random shit that you didn't, you know, that every parent in the world does. And then now there's grounds for them to open and start a case against you. And then you got to jump through this never ending hoops. And if you disrespect them, you speak out against them, you do anything, well, then you're a neglectful parent and they're going to take your kid. And then they come back and they take your kid by force. And then once they have custody of your kid, like I said, there's like a 90 something percent chance that you're not going to get your kid back. Or there's a 54% chance that you're never going to get your kid back. And if you jump through all the hoops, it's probably going to take you a year to do that. And then once they have your kid for a year, and maybe you might be an anti-vaxxer parent, which is probably the number one reason parents get their children taken away. After a year, the child becomes custody of the state. And then the caseworker is automatically going to get your child all 70 something of their childhood vaccines, probably all at once too, in a couple week period. And then you get your kid back and your kid's never the same.
This is unbelievable. I'm so glad to have you on here. I mean, this is tough stuff to talk about, but it's so widespread. And that's exactly what I ask. I mean, most people have no idea. We live in the United States of amnesia and nobody cares or even understands or has any idea of just how bad this is. But how exactly from your research, your deep research, how widespread is this?
Oh, it's absolute insane. So right now, if Kash Patel goes and the FBI goes and kicks in a door and rescues a sex trafficked child, if it's a female, there's a 50 to like an 87% chance that that child came through the welfare system at some point. So whatever we're saving these kids from, the system that we are putting them in is so detrimental that there is a 50 to an 87% chance that if this child is being sex trafficked in America right now, that it came through the welfare system. And if it's a boy, it's like a 62 to like a 77% chance, which is even more crazy. And I forget the odds. It's like somewhere in the 80 or 90% chance that if you go through our welfare system at some point in your life, you're going to be sexually abused.
This is insane.
So it's detrimental. You know what the crazy part is? We thought Trump was going to come in and save this, and Melania did her thing. You want to know what their solution was? It was, we know that the child welfare system and CPS and the entire system's just shit and corrupt. But our solution is we're gonna sign this executive order, whatever, that guarantees that when these kids turn 18, they get access to government jobs before everybody else. And we're gonna give all of the foster care children iPads. And I'm like, so you're guaranteeing these poor children are gonna get sexually abused, raped, most likely sex trafficked at some point in this journey because of CPS. And your solution is congratulations, when you turn 18, we'll get you a job at the post office and here's an iPad for the meantime. That's our government solution to this catastrophic problem. And it all started under the Clintons and then the ASPA Act in like the 1995 or 93, when Bill Clinton passed the ASPA Act, which is like the Americas and Safe Families Adoption Act or whatever it's called. And what it did is it kind of took the COVID strategy. And this is where they got the COVID strategy, right? When you want the local and state government, because at the time, state governments didn't have a big pile of money to fund organizations like CPS. Like CPS all has to get funding, right? Where does it come? It comes from the federal government. Well, how does it come from the federal government? Well, if the state ratifies its state constitution and gives the federal government this authority in their state to operate in their state, then the federal government's going to give them access to all this money. And in the beginning, when they made it out to be like, oh, there's a lot of these bad parents who are abusing and beating, and these children are getting killed by parents who beat them, we could have intervened. Like the warning signs were there, but we didn't have the tools and resources to intervene. So, well, that's how they get the states to ratify all their constitutions. And now there's this big kitty of money. And it's really weird because each part of the process, like the sheriffs go with the caseworkers to the house. So they show up to your house without a warrant and tell you that they have the authority to take your child. And 99% of the time they don't. If they don't have a physical warrant, you tell them to get the hell off your porch, whether they have cops or not. Because if they had a warrant, they would have already kicked your door and they wouldn't be knocking, right? So if they're knocking on your door, it's because they don't have a warrant. And they're going to try to basically convince you to give over and turn over your child. Once you turn over that child, it's done for you. You're in above your head. But the thing is, now also, if they do have a warrant, when the cop physically separates the child from the parent, he takes the child from the parent and hands it to the caseworker, they check a box, right? They have a quota. And if they hit that quota, the local sheriff's department has access to this big kitty of money. So there's these big bounties up there. And all throughout the state, for the doctors that treat them, for the judges that deal with the cases, for the lawyers, for the caseworkers, for the social care workers, they all have quotas to hit. So the more children they take, right? If they're not separating children from mothers that love them, well, they're not getting their quotas. They're not going to get access to this big kid money. They're not getting the new police cars. They're not getting this. And it's all incentivized from our federal government putting up these big kitty of money. It's like we could fix the CPS problem literally just by eliminating the ASPA Act and just pushing it back to the states. Let the state governments figure out how to fund this. And when they realize they don't want to fund it out of the state government, they want to bribe and do kickbacks and do all this other crazy, shady shit. It's just not worth their time to deal with. That would fix 90% of the problem. It probably fix 75% of the problem. I'm sure they'd figure out other ways to reword this. And then they would start highlighting the worst case scenarios and blaming it all on the federal government. And it'd be a nightmare, man. Like our entire system is so rotted to the core. That's why I'm leaving. You know, that's why I'm headed to El Salvador, because El Salvador doesn't have any of these federal funded programs. Like El Salvador has figured it out. By 2030, we're going to save every single sex trafficked child in the entire country of El Salvador. And I can't even get President Trump, who ran on his campaign on, I'm going to go hunt down and find the 350,000 missing migrant children, and we're going to rescue every one of them. Like, it's like, we don't even hear them talking about those missing migrant children. And then every once in a while, they're like, oh, we saved 50,000 children. We've saved 100. It's like, oh, really? You did. You went and saved 100,000 children, and you use anything as a PR opportunity, but you're not going to take this magical, great opportunity to show the 100,000 children that the Biden administration lost. The Democrats did this. It was all blamed on Democrats. Republicans could have came in and looked like the heroes on the Hill. But yet you tell me you found 100,000 children and we haven't heard about it. We haven't seen any photos. You didn't show us the disgusting conditions that they were rescued from. Like, none of that. I'm not saying show us the kids. I'm saying show us some evidence. Where are you taking these? Where did you just put 100,000 kids? Where do we even have a facility that could take 100,000 children? And what are you doing? How many of these children have been raped and abused by staff members at these facilities? And your solution is what? Now we're just going to deport them? So they got sex trafficked and abused and raped and tortured all the way to America. They get to America, they get put into facilities where they're then sexually abused and tortured by the staff members in these facilities that are all funded with our tax dollars. It got so bad that Merrick Garland had to open a lawsuit against Southwest Key Programs, who was the number one organization that was moving all these children all through America, had to file a $50 million lawsuit against them because so many of these children are getting raped by the staff members at these facilities. If I pulled up the lawsuit, just to read off all the cases, that we'd be here for a half hour. 5-year-old girl sexually assaulted by team leader, blah, 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 blah. Pass a note to a teacher. 18-year-old team leader at facility rapes 5-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old, blah, blah, blah. You know, 17-year-old male gets kidnapped by blah, 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 blah. Taken to a hotel and paid for sexual favors for a week before authorities track them down. Like, one after another, man. It was the most insane thing I've ever seen. And that's kind of, you know, I made enough documentaries to put half of these, you know, Alejandro Mayorkas, Xavier Becerra, Robin Mercos. I thought for sure those three scumbags were going to be in prison. Everybody knows Alejandro Mayorkas. He was the head of, you know, DHS, right? He was the Christie Noem of our time, of the Biden administration. Then you had Xavier Becerra, who was RFK. Now, RFK is the one who oversees ORR. RFK is the one who oversees CPS, right? All of those organizations fall under RFK. Okay, so I thought for sure Xavier Becerra was going to be in prison. Xavier Becerra is now like the front runner for the California governor's race.
Wow.
He is going to take the lead here very shortly, and he is most likely going to win the election in California. If you haven't seen how those elections have been playing out with these mail-in ballots over there, there's a 0% chance the Republican who's has a shot in hell right now. I don't even know if he's going to make the ballot, honestly. You might end up having two Democrats like you are for the mayor's race. But yeah, that bastard who should be in prison right now, who I put documentaries out multiple that showed, I mean, he turned America into the child trafficking, kidnapping capital of the world. During the 4 year under the Biden administration, 482,121 migrant children ages 0 to 17 arrived at our border without parents. 482,000. Our government took physical possession of all of them. 350,000 of them they lost, and they lost them after they vetted the adult. So they vetted the adult that they delivered these migrant children to. And they delivered them all across America to every single state. I can show you the town, the city, everywhere, and exactly how many children went to that location or that city. And our government couldn't find 350,000 of them. And by find, I mean, they would call you up and say, hey, Billy, hey, is Jamie doing good? You're like, yep, Jamie's doing good. Okay, thanks, Billy. Click. That's considered a found, safe, good child. If you just answered the phone and acknowledged that the child still existed, great. That's all we need to hear. If you didn't answer, we couldn't track you down, or you didn't return our calls, well, then it was considered a missing child. And that was all we did. One phone call, tried to find them. Nope. And dude, I got a fake ID right here that I went to. I went to New York City to see how easy I could buy a fake ID off a Venezuelan gangbanger, because my buddy told me that they were selling them there. Took me about 15 minutes and I get a complete new identity. I'm John Smith. So how this operation worked was, and when you talk about child trafficking, there's two really dangerous parts of the journey for the child trafficker. The first most dangerous part is delivering the merchandise to the buyer. And the second most dangerous part is bringing the merchandise across the border. So what our government did was, once a child arrived at our border, if it had a name, an address, or a phone number written on its arm in permanent marker or safety pin to its shirt, when Border Patrol would find that child, they would have to process them and put that information into the system as a sponsor. So Border Patrol agents would just see this kid walking and pick him up and be like, hey, you got a family or somebody supposed to contact you? And the four-year-old kid's like, I got this note on my shirt. And the Border Patrol agents takes that information and puts it into his file and says that that's his sponsor. And they call up an NGO and say, hey, we got a child ready for pickup. NGO picks up the child, takes him over to HHS. Then when the child gets to HHS, it's had a shower, it's got some new clothes on, the permanent marker has been rubbed off his arm, and their job is just to reunify the child with the adult. So they call the adult and they say, Billy, you looking for a girl? And you're like, yeah, are you looking for a child? You're like, yeah, I am. All you have to do is have her name and her birth date. You're like, yeah, I'm looking for Julie, 10-10-21. Okay, great. Yeah, congratulations. You get a child. Fill out this FRA application and we'll be back in contact with you. Now, after you fill out the application through WhatsApp, you're going to take a photo of this ID and you're going to send them a photo on WhatsApp, and they're going to go on to Google HHS, who has full access to every FBI database, every tool and resource, is going on to Google and looking up New York ID from 2022, and they're comparing them. And they're going, oh, yep, that looks like a valid ID. Congratulations, Billy, you get a kid. And then here's the John Smith is my name and my address on here. And then they record this name, this address, and I obviously got a burner phone that I'm using. And that's how this game is played. And then after that, they authorize the delivery of the child to the adult, and on your way you go with the child.
Brian, this is just heartbreaking when you hear it up one side and down the other, and most of us don't even want to hear about it. I got to ask, with all the kids, and I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit, because I'm pretty sure you don't know for sure, or maybe you got some pretty deep suspicions. Okay, let's say they take these kids. Well, they're still not popping up anywhere. What exactly is happening? We talking like the kind of stuff that happened in Epstein's book, or, I mean, what are we talking about? Because these kids are never found again. How do you get rid of 300,000 kids? Well, I mean, they just didn't just beam up somewhere. I mean, is the worst happening to these guys, or do we have any idea?
Yeah, I would say everything that you could possibly imagine is happening to these kids. I think the statistics are 54% are used for labor trafficking. So those will be your 14 to 17 year olds are most likely the ones that you'll find in these factories. Probably the ones that are 9 to 12 or 13 that can knit or sew or are, you know, putting little bead things together that are being sold on Etsy, and they're all in basements and they're packing COVID packets, whatever. I mean, anything you can think of, any type of physical labor. And then I think it's 42% are sex trafficked. 6% or 4% are for organ harvesting. And then the other 2 or 1% are for satanic ritual sacrifice. Statistically, according to the experts, if you even consider them that, or you even trust any of the data that the FBI or any of these organizations give us, it's kind of hard to comprehend and really understand how or where they get this data or how it's compiled, because it's so, they purposely don't want to give you accurate information on these topics, because it just makes their organizations look so pathetic. Because I, with the limited time that I've spent investigating child trafficking, with just the resources that our FBI had to hunt down January Sixers, I think I could probably bring 50 to 75% of all sex trafficked children home in America in under a year. Like, that's how quickly I think you could assemble task forces and put together these academies that train law enforcement agencies to be experts in these specific areas. And I think with the right tools that we have, our NSA, our CIA, and you add AI into the mix now, my ability to hunt down these children and these traffickers, I mean, they're all operating in the same type of networks. They're all moving. They have to pay in some type of currency, right? There's all... Once you get the trail on it, you just train AI on it and you have access to infiltrate all these bank accounts. They're already spying on every call, every email. You have Google, NSA, and all these resources. We could bring home all of the children, like 75%. El Salvador is doing it without even lifting a finger, without all of this surveillance and spyware. They've just went after the real root cause of it, which is your politicians, right? If you're corrupt politicians, child trafficking only exists in a country when the politicians allow it to happen. You know, like in China right now, if you go and rape a child, it's like you get executed, right? El Salvador, it's 30 years in prison instantly. Not instantly, I mean, you have a little bit of a trial, but like if you sexually rape a child and let's just say she's 12 and she gets pregnant, and then, you know, they go to the hospital and the hospital takes a DNA test, and finally the girl has the courage to say like, hey, yeah, it was my uncle or my cousin's friend or this guy that I know who's 21 or whatever, above the age of 18, the cops immediately come in. And they'll go hunt down this guy. And then once they find him, the girl comes on to one court hearing through a Zoom hearing. There's DNA evidence. The baby's been born. They know the DNA matches. It matches this dude. She's 12. This guy's 21, right? That dude's going away for 30 years. Or that dude's 40 or 50, right? Instantly gone for 30 years. There's no get out of jail free. There's no you get 20 appeals. It's like when the evidence is so cut and dry, like why do you need to make the person, the victim, relive the trauma? And that's how a lot of these predators get out, because these girls in America, you know, they get raped at say 13, and then the guy's still not even sentenced by the time she's 16. And then after he does get sentenced, then he comes out a couple years later and he's got an appeal, and then he's got another appeal. And before you know it, the guy's done 3 appeals and he's basically out again. And he's remade that girl live that trauma for another like 11 years, basically, is how long they drag these trials on for. Like, our system is so corrupt here.
Yeah, unless, you know, you just happen to have a dual citizenship and you get allowed to get on the first thing smoking right back over to Israel, you know, or, you know, you're somewhere in Trump's orbit and you might get 30 days in jail. You know, we have story after story. But let me kind of switch on over, because, man, you're doing a lot of awesome, incredible things, and you're calling truth to power in so many different ways. You mentioned El Salvador a little bit ago. The people in this audience understand that I was down there maybe a few weeks ago. And then prior to that, I think in the last 3 months, I've been to El Salvador twice. So what drew your attention? I know you kind of led into it a little bit there, but what drew your attention, let's say, primarily to El Salvador? And you mentioned Bukele. What are your thoughts on him as well?
Yeah, man, we can go. It's really such an amazing story. So I, as a Bitcoiner, right, you're naturally attracted to El Salvador because of what President Bukele has done down there. And you start hearing all these things, and you're hearing the mainstream media tell you one thing, and then you're watching your Bitcoin homies go down there and put out all these videos, and you're watching these inspirational documentaries. And it was 2023, the first time me and my buddy Eric V. Stacks decided to come up with the idea to make a Bitcoin documentary. So we made this plan. We were kind of kicking the can down the road. And then one day he hits me up. He's like, hey, man, like, I'm going to El Salvador. I think like there's going to be like 5 or 10 Bitcoiners there, and we wanted to interview, you know, a handful of key Bitcoiners, and like they were going to be all at the one place at one time. He's like, can you come down to El Salvador and let's kick this thing off? He's like, we might be able to knock out 3 or 4 of these interviews like right here on the spot. And I'm like, absolutely, let's do it. So I booked a flight down there, And I went down there, and by that time he was on like this Bitcoin tour from all these different conferences, and he just got burnt out. And he's like, hey man, like I'm a family guy. Like it's too much for my family. Like I don't have time to travel and film this documentary. So I was like, okay, cool. So I just kind of got to travel and just go experience what El Salvador was. And I instantly fell in love. And by the last night there, there was like the after party for the Bitcoin event. And I got invited to this guy, Will's house at Club Cacao. And this girl walks up to me, her name's Claudia. And she's like, hey, what do you do? And I'm like, I'm child trafficking expert, documentary filmmaker, blah, blah. And she's like, what do you guys do with the children after you save them? And I'm like, unfortunately, I've never met one organization that I could tell you, like, if you wanted to donate money to, you could donate money here and it's actually going to go to saving these children. And we have a few, you know, like Aerial Rescue and a few that actually go and kick down the doors. And, you know, the Association for the Recovery of Children ran by Basil Baz. Like there are a few really good organizations out there that I've learned of since. But at this time, I didn't really know of any. And she's like, well, you got to meet this guy named Bob McDonald. He runs the House of Life here in El Salvador. And I'm like, okay, sure. You know, everybody tells me this, you know. And you go into these organizations in America and you see the girls. And when you walk in, if they even let you in the building, like most of the time, senators can't even get in these buildings, right? And you see the kids and they're like this, they're timid. They're looking at you out of the corner of their eye. Like they're scared. Like they want to cry out for help, but they know if they even open their mouth and say anything negative that they'll, you know, basically be beaten, abused, tortured, whatever the case may be. And I walked into this facility, this place called the House of Life. And it was just like, I seen these girls laughing and joking and, you know, nursing their children. And then Bob walks in and these girls are hugging him like they're his father, like they're their father, right? He's their father. And it's just, I could see the look in their eyes when they looked at him. They looked at this man like he was their idol, like they idolized him, like they had saved him. And I know that, you know, this organization's fairly new. And I know, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, these girls were being sexually raped by their fathers, by their stepfathers, by their brothers, pimped out by their mothers. Like these girls have come out of the worst conditions humanly imaginable. And I'm seeing the look of joy on their face. Like, I didn't even think that was possible to go through the damage and the torture and the lifestyle that they went through. And then to turn around that quick. And I was just so amazed. And then next thing I know, Bob's like, yeah, man, we're not going to be able to make rent this month. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah. I'm like, how much does this operation cost? Because in America, these operations cost millions, you know? And he's like, it's only like $3,000 a month. And I'm like, wait, you can keep this organization open for a year for $30,000? I'm like, bro, I'm putting out a documentary on child trafficking in like 2 weeks. I'm like, let me go home. Let me record a video. I'll just stuff it into this documentary and I'll ask people to donate, right? You got to give, send, go, and everything set up. He's like, yeah, it's all through our website, blah, 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 blah. And then, so I put out this documentary and within like 3 days, maybe even 7 days tops, my audience, we had raised over $10,000. Then Nicole Shanahan, RFK's VP, gets wind of this. And my buddy, Ian Carroll, you guys, a lot of your audience probably knows Ian Carroll. He hits me up. He's like, hey man, he's like, is this Bob McDonald dude legit? You know, I'm like, yeah, why? He's like, because Nicole Shanahan wants to go down there and see it. And I'm like, dude, bro, I just vouched as much as I could for him. He's like, that's all I needed to hear. I figured it's easier just to call you directly. I haven't watched any of your documentaries yet. Just wanted to hear it directly from your mouth. I got you. Nicole Shanahan's on a flight like a week later. She pledges, I don't know, at least $10,000. Next thing you know, we raised $30,000 in like a month. And that triggered off like this chain of events where we ended up at Bitcoin Vegas in 2025. And we raised almost 2 Bitcoin for Bob in the House of Life.
Wow.
And we've just been on this relentless cycle. I'm getting ready to put out a new documentary called the Bukele Effect. And one of the first documentaries is going to focus on what Bob's done down there. But it all stems from Bukele, right? But we're going to try to raise $1 million because Bob is not only going to save every sex trafficked child in the entire country of El Salvador by 2030. He started taking in the rape pregnant teenage girls because he's been down there in El Salvador since like the 80s, basically, and been taking children since like the 90s. And he has these two group homes where he just takes normal kids that have been abandoned by their parents, ages basically like 2 to 17. But he doesn't kick them out when they turn 17. They can stay there as long as they follow the rules and they become their productive member of the house, right? So then the government came to him one day and was like, hey, Bob, like we have these orphan children. And an orphan child, a baby specifically, you know, like 0 to 1, in the first like 90 to 180 days of being born, if the baby's brain isn't stimulated enough, if it basically lays in the crib and is fed and then cries and lays back in the crib and is changed and that's all the attention the baby gets, the baby will develop severe brain damage and it can't be reversed. So Bob had an idea, like, well, what if I get the mothers before the babies are born, right? So that's how he ended up getting the girls. Then he realized the government's still taking in these, like there's still girls that are having children and there's no abortions in El Salvador. So the girls are just giving their children up or the girls come from really bad lives and they just abandon the children, whatever the case may be, the government's still getting these orphan children, and the government doesn't have the resources or the ability to take care of all these kids. So the government reached out to Bob and said, hey, Bob, do you think you could take these kids? And Bob's like, yeah, if I have the right funding, we build the right apparatus. So Bob comes up with the ideas. Hey, all these rich El Salvadorians now that came to America have made lots of money, have bought houses and worked there. El Salvadorians are really good with their money, right? So the ones that have came to America have been smart. They've tucked away, they saved, they've paid off their houses, and they're sitting on this house now. You know, a two-bedroom house is pretty much a $500,000. So the retirement homes and the retirement communities here in America are anywhere from, I think it's like $10,000 to $30,000 a month per month, and they can range up to $50,000 if you need full-time care. So Bob came up with the idea, and he just got 12 acres donated. It's right across from the beach at Pier 51 in El Salvador. He's got 12 acres of land, and he wants to build this retirement community for old people. He wants to build another house of life where all the girls are at. And he wants to build a child orphanage, three different facilities, but all on the same property. So the girls that are coming through the house of life, the ones that have came from one house of life, they've been there for a year or so. They're raising their babies. They kind of got stability. They're maybe 17 to 18 to 19, whatever. They can help take care of the old people and get paid to do it, because the old people that are retiring are going to have basically a retirement community on the beach. Then a lot of these old people, they don't have a big family. They don't have really a purpose in life. Well, we have all these orphan babies. So the grandmas and the grandpas that are retired and want purpose in life can go over and volunteer and help nurture and play with and stimulate the babies. And then the girls can go shopping and do all the things that they need to do to take care of the old people. So the old people are going to help take care of the babies, and the girls are also going to help take care of the babies as well, but they're also going to help take care of the old people. And you're going to create this circle of life. And Bob can build out this organization for $1 million. That's all it's going to take. And then it'll be self-sufficient, because part of the retirement community where the old people are going to be is going to be paid, right? So these people are going to pay, you know, anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 a month. And then even in America, when you go in to stay in these facilities, you know, it's like your insurance covers $200,000, or you actually have to put $200,000 up front, or your family does. And then they get 90% of that back when you pass away, right? So you have this place to live, and then that initial funding will build the resort or the you know, the unit specifically for that elderly couple. And then next thing you know, in El Salvador, we're going to save every orphan child. We're going to save all the sex trafficked children, and we're going to take care of all of the retirees who just need to be taken care of in El Salvador. And it's going to be magical. And I call that the Bukele effect, right? None of this is funded by the government. And this is just the effect of when the government gets out of your way and arrests all the corrupt politicians, puts all the criminals in jail, turns the deadliest country in Latin America to the safest country in the Western hemisphere. You now have a higher probability of being killed by a coconut falling on your head in El Salvador than you do by a gangbanger. And yeah, man. And you're just watching people like myself going down there, right? I'm doing real estate, but 10% of the money that I make from real estate is all going to the House of Life and to help save and build this mission to save all these sex trafficked children. My buddy Will is doing real estate down there, and he's the one who just donated the 12 acres. He also donated a piece of land in Statia where these girls are going to have this house that's in this, basically, it's again a development he's doing. There's going to be 21 developments in there, 21 units. And then all of those are most likely going to be investors that want Airbnbs. So the girls that are going to have one lot there, it'll be like four girls per house. And then those four girls will be able to do the Airbnb cleanings. There's mangoes and jam and fruits and veggies and all this stuff. So they're going to be making like banana jam, mango jam, you know, raspberry jam, strawberry jam. They're going to have a jam making business. And it's just this really cool thing that you're just seeing happen in El Salvador. It's like everybody, like yourself, talking about coming down there, right? Like, I'm sure you're going to get the itch too. It's like, we want to go to El Salvador, not to exploit it, but just to help it thrive, because we're all kind of playing our part in helping Bukele turn El Salvador into what I think will be, I say Dubai, like the Dubai of Latin America or the Singapore of Latin America, but I don't think it's going to be anything like Dubai or Singapore. I mean, it's going to be wealthy. It's going to be rich. I think all of the El Salvadorians, because it's their country, like you go to Dubai or the UAE, for example, and the UAE, the natural UAE, they're the richest. They're the wealthiest. You almost have this slave class of foreigners that have came in, and the foreigners work for pennies on the dollar. And all of the locals there, they own the real estate, they have the best jobs. The government gives you in Dubai a gold visa, right? So you don't actually, as a foreigner, you come in there, I know a guy that's went into Dubai and he's invested $40 billion. He's been there for 40 years and he still doesn't have UAE citizenship. He still doesn't have, you know, as a UAE citizen, the government gives you your first home loan tax-free. They give you, they'll buy your first farm. If you want a farm, you can tell them 5, 10, or 20 acres, and they'll come and build a cement wall concrete wall 8 feet high around your entire farm. They'll give you goats. They'll give you chickens. They'll give you horses. They'll give you a loan to buy a tractor at 0% interest. So they have access to all these. If you want to go to college anywhere in the world and you're a member of the UAE or Dubai, the government will pay for it. Like my buddy from the UAE came over here and went to like Berkeley, all paid for by the UAE government. That's all perks that you have as a naturalized citizen. That's all shit we should have here. America should be the greatest country in the world. Like we're taking in what, 1 million immigrants a year. Why are the immigrants come here? They don't have the HB1 visas. They don't have to pay Social Security. I don't give a shit if they're not getting Social Security. If they are over here working, why are they not paying into it for us? Right? Why are they getting perks and getting to pay less taxes than American citizens? It doesn't make sense, man. So you're watching Bukele and what he's done in El Salvador, and we can go into it even deeper. But it's amazing what that man has accomplished in such a short period of time.
You can still see to this day when you go through El Salvador, you can still, I mean, you've been through what, 3 civil wars in 50 years. You've had gangbangers, you know, brought about by, you know, Operation Condor from our government, the whole nine yards. These guys have been the recipients of some of the worst treatment in the world. And then you can still see it. You can see it to a certain extent. There's not a home in a lot of places that doesn't have bars in the windows. They put, in some cases, more investment into their fencing than they do in the actual house, because that's the way it was. But you can definitely feel the change. You know, Ryan, as I'm listening to you talk there, I'm thinking, you know what? Let's just pretend for a minute. Bukele was actually in charge of the United States of Amnesia. What would, okay, knowing what he did, I want to just do a mental game here. What would he do here if, by some miracle, we were able to rewrite the Constitution and we said, okay, now we got a President Bukele here in the United States of Amnesia. What do you think, based on what you saw in El Salvador, what would he do that should be done in this country right now?
Oh, let's go through this. This is such an awesome question, man. Great question. You know, and you could also do it state by state, right? You could get the right people elected in a state. That state, like Texas, could easily secede from the United States and they could do the same playbook. Okay, so first thing Bukele did when he ran for mayor of Cuscalon, right? Because you have to have somebody that the people kind of trust. So Bukele didn't just come out of nowhere. And I didn't know this till this last trip I was down there and I started to interview people for this new documentary I'm working on. And I interviewed two of these experts, this gentleman by the name of Herb and a gentleman by the name of Jose. And they told me the whole story. And they both told me at separate times, but almost the exact same thing. So when he became mayor the first time, now Bukele comes from a wealthy family. His dad was a rich businessman in El Salvador. His family name was well known. He could have rode off into the sunset like Trump and had this great luxury life. You know, and like I know in El Salvador, it was dangerous, but it was mainly dangerous for anybody below the upper middle class, right? Like the rich elite people live in specific areas. The specific areas are well sectioned off. The criminals know to not mess with the people in these areas, because if you do, you know, these are the millionaires and billionaires that have, you know, connections to powerful governments, their connections to the United States governments, their ambassadors, their, you know, they work at the U.S. embassy. Like these are basically hands off. So these types of people in El Salvador in these specific areas, the rich areas, had a completely different lifestyle than the average El Salvadorian did now, right? And they all know that there were no-go zones and red zones. So Bukele became mayor of Cuscalon, and he said he was going to take on violent crime. And he said he was going to reduce the homicide rate by a certain percent. He took it to zero. And all he did was went to the police, gave them the proper weapons, the proper training, and he increased the amount of police in the streets, and he gave them the vehicles that they needed to patrol the streets. And in his, he became mayor of a city, like the size of Detroit, basically. So he became the mayor of this city, which is like the equivalent of becoming the governor of a state here in the United States. So we'll call it like the governor of, you know, Florida, basically. So in that area, he took violent crime to zero. Homicide rate went to zero. And all he did, but he did that because the criminals knew they could go a state, they could go a town over, a city over, right? Mm-hmm. And commit all the crime and get away with it. And there was no chance they were going to get hunted down by the police. There was no chance they were going to get caught. They weren't going to have to go to court, even though the judges were letting them back out and they pretty much owned and controlled the whole system. They still had to go through the process and it was uncomfortable and they had a record and it was on there, you know, blah, 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 blah. So he did that. And the people were like, wow. So then when he ran for mayor of San Salvador, which is the capital, people were like, yeah, let's give this guy a shot. And when he did, he said he was going to fix the water crisis. So there was a big water issue with clean water, getting clean water into the city. That half the houses didn't have it. The water was disgusting. They couldn't bathe for certain days of the week. And it was just atrocious. And Bukele went to the federal government and said, hey, I have a solution to fix this. Can we do it? And the federal government's like, no. And it was even members. So when he ran for the mayor of Escuscalón, he created his own party called the Nuevi Ideas Party, right? And that was the party that he was. So it'd be like in America, us creating an independent party, right? The American party, like Elon wanted to create. And you get a few people in on that party. So he comes in as mayor and he starts recruiting more people and getting more people into the government. He starts to get this little coalition and he becomes mayor of San Salvador. And even members of his own party are like, dude, you're not going to do this. You're not going to get this done. And his way of going about it was, well, I'm just going to go on to every podcast. I'm going to go on to every media network, even the ones that don't like me. And I'm going to talk about what my ideas are. And I'm going to let the people be the judge, basically. So then he started explaining things and breaking it down on like a, you know, here's the process, like first principle standpoint, like here's what the problem is. Here's the solution to the problem. And here's how we get the resources and funding, right? Like we got this, you know, anti-child corruption program that we're spending $5 million a year on. And, you know, our youth are like the most violent, the most dangerous and most deadly they've ever been. Obviously this program that's been running for the last 10 years and we're spending $5 million a year on it isn't doing us any good. I only need $1 million in funding to get this done. Why don't we cut $1 million from that program and give everybody clean water here? These are the things that just common sense that just makes sense to do, right? And everybody was against them, all the NGOs, all the social workers. At this time, you had the government had basically been like the left wing had been in power for 10 years and they were partnered with the gangs and destroyed the country. And then the right wing came into power for 10 years and then they destroyed the country and the left wing came back into power. It didn't matter left or right. They all realized it was this giant uniparty that was working against the best interests of the citizens. So federal government says no. And basically Bukele goes and makes a partnership with this company, gets them to drill wells. And it's like, hey, if you guys hit water, because you don't know in El Salvador, when you start drilling, it might be 30 feet, it might be 40 feet, or it might be 1,000 feet, right? And you just drill until you hit. And then the dollars are racking up every foot, every centimeter that you're going down. And he partnered with these companies, put these wells in, and boom, he got water for the citizens. And he did it all out of his own pocket without help from the federal government. So then everybody, he became like the talk of the town, the talk of the country. And then he did the same thing with crime in the capital, in San Salvador. And you know, the capital is quite big. It's a massive part of the country. It, you know, probably there's like 6 million people. I think probably 2 or 3 million people probably live in San Salvador in that jurisdiction. So that at that point, man, he had the backing of the people. And he ended up running for president. And then when he ran on president, he said, I'm going to do the same thing, right? So when he got into power, he became president. And then he still had the left wing in there. He still had the right wing. And he still had some corrupt members of his own party that were kind of infiltrated and fighting against him. And then one day the cartels come out. And well, now Bukele had built the mega prisons, right? And he said that they were going to start cracking down on crime. It took like a year and a half or 2 years to get the mega prisons built. They were finally up and running. And they were finally ready to start arresting the gangbangers. And they were going to go basically to these mega prisons. So the gangbangers and cartels still controlled the judges. They still had this network of NGOs operating in America that were funding all these woke causes and dividing and destroying the country. And then at the time, you know, you're up against every single mainstream media outlet. USAID El Salvador was the first country that USAID started operating in. So USAID in 1963 started operating in El Salvador. Same with National Endowment for Democracy and same with this entire network of NGOs. Like El Salvador had it the worst. They were the breeding ground for this regime change operation. And that's what led to the multiple civil wars, the gang violence. We went one time went and rounded up all of the MS-13 gang members. I think it was in 2012 or this was in 2001. And like we rounded up all of the MS-13 gang members from Mexico, from America, from California, from Texas, from Florida. We took them in military planes and just took them to the airport in El Salvador and just let them out. They didn't even tell the government we were doing it. We just dumped thousands of the most violent gangbangers and criminals in the country of El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And just, here you guys go, have fun. So Bukele did this. And then the cartel members went out one weekend and they slaughtered 163 innocent people. And I'm pretty sure that one of his like sergeant in arms, the guy that basically put together the detail to go and round up and take over city by city and round up all these gangbangers, he put the playbook together. His son was one of the people that got killed that weekend. And that gave that caused so much public outrage because the cartel members were like, we're going to war. We're going to kill anybody we want. And they just went and mowed down innocent shop owners, grandmas, brothers, cousins. They didn't care. It was anybody just to send a message to Bukele. You don't control this country. We do. That forced the government, the members of his government, immediately called an emergency vote. And he wanted to temporarily suspend the Constitution. And that was, boom, it was it. That was also going into the election season. It was like right around the corner. So at that point, suspended the Constitution and started going and saying, okay, If you got gang tattoos that show how many people you've killed, if we've arrested you already and you have this criminal record, you know, if your grandma calls and snitches on you and says that, you know, you're part of these gangs, we are going and rounding up all of them. Okay, straight to jail. Do not pass go. You don't get to call anybody. You don't get to whatever. You just went pretty much straight to jail at first. If you had tattoos that killed, that showed how many people you killed, and you went and rounded up all of these gangbangers and 88,000 of them and put them in these mega prisons. Now, what's really cool about this is if members of your local community, because I've met three people that have gotten out now that were rounded up in that. And if your family members, if the people in your community were saying, hey, like writing letters on your behalf, you know, your family could go to all the neighbors and say, hey, like my son wasn't a gangbanger, will you please write this letter? And you get enough letters and you turn them in, the government, oh, we made a mistake. Okay, you're actually a good one. You will be a productive member of society. We'll admit we made a mistake, and they'll let these people out. So they're not like there's no way to get out and there was no hope and innocent people are just rotting behind bars. I've only met one person whose brother and sister were tattoo artists. Now, you're a tattoo artist in a town where the gangs control it. You're obviously going to tattoo the gang members and you're probably going to have some gang tattoos on you, right? So they had the gang tattoos. They claimed that they weren't really part of the gang, but they were forced to be into the gang and kind of got wrapped up in this, and they're behind bars. Okay, so there's one person I've met that claims that they're innocent, but that's what he did. And then, so now he gets control. Now his party has a majority, right? Which is what you really need. So that's when they just started changing and passing laws that just made sense. And then it was, I think it was after his third year, he called like a State of the Union to address his members of Congress. And he said, here's the mandate that we've been given from the people. They want corruption eradicated from politics. So I'm going to order my attorney general to investigate and keep these open, ongoing investigations into every person in this room, including myself. And he goes, and if you find anybody that's breaking the law or committing crimes, he goes, arrest them on the spot. He goes, that is the mandate from the people. And that is the mandate we are going to uphold in my administration. So in that go down right there, five more politicians got arrested. Three of them were from his own party. So it just goes to show you this. He's not playing a political game, right? He is creating a government that serves the people, right? And if you are going to be in the government, you have a job. And your job is you're getting paid with these people's tax dollars. They go to work, they work a 9-to-5 and they pay you so that you can provide a service to the people. That is your job, is to make, as a government employee, to make the lives better for the people that you represent. And that's kind of the motto that he's made. And that's why I say it's everybody from the president down to the secretary of state, he's eradicated corruption. You're like, well, how did he do that? Well, let's just use like at the state level for like developments, right? You're a developer and you want to take 5 acres of land and you want to chop it up, right? There's a process. You have phase 1, 2, and 3. Phase one is you say, go to the city and say, hey, here's my idea. I want to turn this 5 acres into, you know, 20 plots. And they go, okay, yeah, looks like an okay idea. You can do it. But if you're going to do that, here's the requirements. So phase two is you getting the requirements. And you look at it like, okay, your road has to be 1.5 lanes wide. You have to put drains here for the water runoff because everything's mountains in El Salvador. So they don't want a developer basically buying a side of a mountain and then cementing the whole thing and then creating, you know, tidal waves that wash the cars off the road, or landslides that are going to create, you know, a bunch of chaos down the road. So they're pretty strict about what you can and can't do there, but in phases. So previously, it was all done at the local level. So at that specific city, they had the final say. So whoever worked at the local, basically, we call it the Secretary of State. And you go to the Secretary of State to submit your paperwork. And well, if you want it to get through, now you got to pay, right? So $1,000 here, $500 here, you got to bribe off this person, you got to grease the wheel here. And it still might take you a year just to get from phase 1 to phase 2. I submitted my paperwork on Monday. It was approved on Wednesday. So what Bukele did is he created a federal organization called like DOT or MOT. I forget the exact abbreviation for it. But what happens is like now it's digital. So when you submit your paperwork, it still stays local. The local people, the authorities have the first approval to approve or deny it, right? And they have 14 days. I mean, you have a job to do. That's your only job, is to just approve these documents. It shouldn't be hard for you to take a look at them all. And there's not that many of them, and make a decision. Now, if you deny it, then it gets kicked up to the federal level. And you have a federal person who's all independent. And the way that it sends these like alerts out or these checks out, it's random to different authorities. So the same person sitting at the federal level isn't going to know the state. This guy is not going to know who's getting his invoice right at the top if he denies it. So what basically happens is, if he wants foreign investors to come in, he wants locals to come in, he wants people to develop, and they want to build and provide jobs for El Salvadorians, and he wants money coming into the country. So if you're going to deny somebody doing a development, you better have a good reason. And if it's a good reason, great, no problem. The person that stops says, yep, I agree on that. Reject it, shoots it back, and then it's sent back to the person. If not, the federal person's like, well, wait, this is some bullshit here. What's going on here? Right. And then they start, maybe you need to look at, maybe an investigation needs to happen into that person at the city level. Right. So they just don't know. So now it's like every way for there to be corruption, he's working and putting systems in place to basically prevent that corruption from taking place and eradicate it. And now every member of their entire government, from the president to the secretary of state, goes into work with one mission. How do we make life better for the citizens of our country? And I tell people it'd be the equivalent of like, let's just say we could replicate Thomas Massey, and Thomas Massey was put into every government position in our entire government. How much quicker, how much better would our lives get? How much quicker would our lives get better? Like, it would be like, boom. And then one of the cool things he did in the beginning. So first thing he did was build the mega prisons to house the real criminals, right? Then he went and rounded up the gangbangers. Then he cut off funding coming into these NGOs, right? So the United States government funnels billions of dollars into the NGOs. The NGOs use it to buy, bribe off the politicians. They use it to grease the wheel. They create these organizations that employ hundreds or thousands of local El Salvadorians, and then they indoctrinate them and they brainwash them, and they go, oh, hey, this organization's not funded by profits. It's funded by the United States tax dollar. So when we need 1,000 people to go protest, we just say, hey, employees, all 1,000 of you, you know, the next 3 days, if you don't want to come into work, we'll pay you for going to this protest if you want to take a part of it. We think it's a good cause. So that's how they get thousands of people out in these protests. And then we have the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador. It's the largest one in the world, or one of the largest, has 3,000 people at it. And I'm like, wait, what do you mean? We got 3,000 Americans that work at an embassy. Like, what are they doing? What are these 3,000 Americans? What are we paying the salary of 3,000 Americans? And I've talked to people down there that know, and they're like, dude, like, these Americans are treated like royalty down here. They got their own houses that are paid for by the government, gives them these houses. They got this huge community that they all live in. They go into the embassy and they're like barely ever working, and they're like laughing and joking. They're all out on hour to 2 hour lunches every day, all bought and paid for with our tax dollars. And they just live like royalty in these countries. So anybody that works for any one of these embassies, I mean, they're not going to say anything negative. They're not going to rat on the crew, but yeah. I know, but I'm all right. Give me 1 second.
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about, folks. Folks, when this is why I asked that question, because this problem is not that difficult to solve. As you hear what Ryan's saying right now, you know, like Jefferson said, when the people fear the government, there's tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. That's exactly what we got going on in this world. And that's why, you know, I'm seeing this country go down the toilet, and I'm asking critical questions about where the good Lord would want to put me. You know, is it El Salvador? Is it Guatemala? Is it Honduras? Is it Nicaragua? And then overlaying that information with some of the information I got from Dr. Jack Cruz and Dane Wigington, Ariana Masters, and then Ryan also, I'm asking everybody about their experience in this place. So when you get down to brass tacks, folks, maybe the United States of Amnesia isn't the best country in the world that everybody keeps talking about. So Ryan, let me kick it on back to you. And I know you probably got to get running here, and I got a whole gang of other things I wanted to ask you regarding, you know, the genocide in the Middle East and all these other things. I guess we'll probably have to circle back at another time and maybe cover some of that. But, you know, it looks like you've really taken a big plunge and, you know, heading down there. I mean, what's that transition look like for you? I mean, clearly you got family up here. How do you intend to, are you going to divide your time? Are you going there and just burning the passport? I mean, what are you doing?
Yeah, man. So it's, you know, it's tough because, you know, my son's 13 and it's hard because there's no future for him here, right? Like, I can't build a future for my child in the country that I loved, right? That I grew up in, that I called home, that I once thought was the greatest nation. At one point, I would be honored if my son would have joined the military, right? And he's my only child at this point. So I was thinking to myself, like, my son never grew up and wanted to join the military. I'd be proud, man. Like, what an honorable thing to do, to go serve for your country. It builds a moral compass. You know, we're going to get Trump in, we're going to get out of these wars, you know? So like, if he decided at 18, you know, we have a good government and Trump's eradicated the corruption, yeah, I'd be proud for him to do that. And now I look at, if you join this military, I think you are the most biggest sucker in the world, right? I absolutely love our troops, have the most respect for them. But like, when you're taking orders and you're going over to Israel to drop bombs on innocent women and children, you're going to fight and kill people in Iran who have done nothing wrong to anybody, that have just defended their country for the last 40 years since we carried out the last regime change over there. It's like, we have been a plague on the world stage, right? We keep countries like El Salvador, Mexico, Peru, Guatemala in these perpetual states of corruption because we don't want them to ever become developed nations. Because if they do, then they're pulling their oil out and they're pulling their natural resources. And we don't control all that in the technology game, right? Like, look at China and what they're inventing. We can't stop it now. Look at Russia. We can't stop it now. So it's like these countries are all fighting to make the world a better place. And we're over here attempting to just destroy the world. It's insane, man. So I have no choice but to go there, right? So like right now, I'm just getting my feet wet, right? I bought some real estate. I'm trying to build a few rentals. I'm trying to do and build a future. But like, I don't want to go there and get a job there. I don't want to take work away from an El Salvadorian. So trying to navigate this, it's a really unique experience, I would say, to say the least. But I think I'm doing okay, man. I've made a lot of mistakes that have cost me a lot of money. And that's why I'm kind of building like a everything El Salvador. It's called Everything SV. So SV is the abbreviation for El Salvador. So I'm building a website right now called everythingsv.com. And it's going to be basically your one-stop shop. So I have, you want a real estate agent. I'm getting you the best real estate agents that are going to get you the actual best price in El Salvador, because you've been down there. You've talked to some people. You get the gringo price, right? Like you're an investor. You're from a foreign country. They know it. They know you got M's, and they're just going to try to make as much money and much profit. So if you go into an El Salvadorian, you're going to go to somebody who's also selling real estate for an El Salvadorian, and you're getting the El Salvadorian price. You want to get you need an attorney that's not going to rip you off, and he's going to get the job done immediately. Like, you want your residency, right? I got an attorney. So I'm giving everybody access to this website, which is going to have all of this information. You know, the first most important thing, you know, if you're even thinking about doing it 2 years from now and you don't understand Spanish, like, that was the biggest setback for me, is not speaking Spanish. And I'm now back on it again. Every single day I'm studying for 2 to 4 hours a day, and I'm relentless about taking these Spanish lessons, because I'm doing this development, and my contractor, my first one that ripped me off for about $100,000. One day I show up and he's walking me around my property and he's showing me what he's done. I'm like, oh, awesome. And we're communicating through Google Text app, and I got the Meta glasses, and it's translating into my ear while I'm at the same time using this app on my phone to translate it. And somehow I agreed to build a $22,000 privacy wall without a contract, without a quote, without an invoice, without ever signing off on anything. I come back and my manager, she's sending me videos of my property. And I'm like, what's that wall? And she's like, oh, that's the wall that Marlon said you ordered. I'm like, when did I order it? She's like, well, you said that you agreed to it. And when he was showing you around your property, and I'm like, I didn't agree to it. Somehow I agreed to a $22,000 privacy wall that I didn't know about. Like, so these are all the things. Like, number one, Spanish is super important. Then the next one is getting your residency immediately. When I first went down there, you had to be down in the country for 8 months of the year, actually in country for 8 months total. You could leave and go at any time you wanted, but you couldn't be gone for more than 90 days. And then you had to be there for at least 8 months. Now, Bukele just changed that. So you only have to be in country for a total of 90 days, but you can't leave for, I think, more than 90 days at a time. So those are the only two requirements. So as long as you come and go and you stay there for at least 90 days of the year, you can get your residency. You get your 1 year. Then after your 1 year, you apply for your 2 year. So that'll be a total of 3 years. And then after 3 years, you can apply for your permanent residency. And then I think after 5 years, you can get your El Salvadorian passport. So that's kind of like the steps are learning Spanish, getting your first residency. And then that requires you to get your background check done here in America. So you have to go, like, in Michigan, every state's different. Sometimes you go to your sheriff's office, or sometimes you go to these special places. Like, I went to this one special place. I actually did both because I wasn't sure what one was going to be fastest, and I wanted to get it done right away. So you just basically go into this place. They do your fingerprints. Their portal connects to the FBI's thing. You're bringing a passport photo. You get that done at the post office, or you can get that done at like CVS or Walgreens or Rite Aid. And then you basically submit all these documents, and then they come back 30 days later, and you have to have it apostilled, which means it has to be printed on this specific type of paper and like bound together in this booklet. And then that gets, you know, basically you have to overnight that, or you have to FedEx that, or DHL it down to El Salvador to my attorney's office. And then he goes and does everything for you. You have to be down there for like a week or maybe 10 days or something like that. And then day one, he like meets you, and you go into these offices and you fill out all these documents, and you make copies of paperwork and your passport, and you submit it all. But my attorney's right there with you, so he walks you through this. And he speaks English. So if you don't speak English, you can get this ball rolling as well. And then from there, man, just trying to figure out whether you want to build, whether you want to do real estate. You know, I look at America, and, you know, something that's always going to generate people money is having a rental property. So if you think you're going to go down there, and even if you build yourself, right, if you're a construction worker, if you're a contractor, you know, you can build your own house if you wanted to, or you could buy a house and then build a few rentals on your property, and then you have income coming in. So figuring out how you can get income, I tell people, you know, if you have the ability to generate money online, right, whether you're a YouTuber, a podcaster, a translator, online coach, a virtual assistant, right, there's plenty of ways to make money online. And for $2,500 a month, you can live very well in El Salvador for $2,500 a month. Not exceptionally well, but you can live a good life for $2,500. For $5,000 a month, you can live like royalty down there. So, you know, like my haircuts are $5. When I first went there, they were $3. You know, you go to Pizza Hut and you can get, not that you should eat Pizza Hut, but you get a personal pizza, breadsticks, and a pop for $3.99 in El Salvador right now. Like everything is so, I can go down to the beach and on at like one of the beach resorts down there, I can get steak and lobster with two sides, a salad, and a pop for $17.99 or $15.99. It's like, it's so cheap. I mean, there's definitely higher, more upscale restaurants, but if you wanted to eat on a budget, you can eat for $5 all day long, like a full meal for $5 easily. So like your ability to live down there is so much cheaper. There's no property taxes. So once you buy your property, you own it for life, which I think is one of the most important aspects about El Salvador. And then if you keep the property for over a year and you sell it for a year and that's your only property and it's not like an investment, whatever, then when you sell it, it's just you pay your 13% sales tax. That's it. When you buy it, you pay your 13% sales tax on it. Yeah, that's it, man. My water bill I paid for the year was $72.
Wow.
My electricity bill, my first one was like 45. Now I got two AC units that are running 24/7. So the last one I got was like $175, but that's with construction workers there building, running power drills 24/7, you know, me charging 5 batteries a day that I'm burning through on all my hand equipment and then running 2 full AC units 24/7. So, you know, I'm burning up electricity. So I definitely think solar power would be the way to go. If you could do solar power down there, you definitely can. I mean, it's almost always sunny. It's almost always hot down there. The coldest it gets is like, in most of the country, there's definitely parts that are way higher up that get probably, you know, in the lower 60s, but it's basically 60 to 90 degrees pretty much all year round down there. They have the rainy season. So that's about it, man. I think that, you know, making that leap is just, I think you're going to look back at, and especially you buy any real estate, you know, it's a small country. Everybody in the world thinking what we're thinking, or there's millions of, there's billion, 8 billion people around the world. And they're all looking and going, yeah, do I really want to live here? Right. Even the people in China live in this almost like police state, right? They might not want to live there, but the wealthy ones have every opportunity to go out and invest and do things outside their country. Then you have people in Europe, Canada, the United States. Like, how many millionaires do you know? Probably quite a few, right? I think we all know, you know, probably 10 to 20 to 50 to 100 millionaires, right? And they're all probably thinking the same thing we are. Like, even the people that don't pay attention to politics are starting to pay attention to the chemtrails. They're starting to pay attention to fluoride in our water. They're starting to see ticks in their backyard they've never seen before. They're starting to hear these horror stories. They're starting to watch. They're watching our government. Just like even the most loyal Trump supporters now, if you're not MEGA, right? If you're not pro-Israel, like you're looking at Trump, like what the hell happened to this man, right? So we're all seeing the writing on the walls and we realize like what would need to be done for like a Bukele to come in and save America. And you're looking at least one, if not two presidential cycles away. So at least 6 years of just complete, utter breakdown of society and civilization. If Democrats get the supermajority, the entire Biden and border operation is still in play. And yeah, man, these are, I think America's worst days are right around the corner, if not, you know, consistently down the corner for the next 6 to 8 years at least, before you get, the country gets so bad that, you know, the people are out in the streets and the rioting and, you know, eventually you end up maybe with, well, you know what a third world country is it's, there's no middle class. Like by definition, just at the most layman terms, it's just, there's really no middle class. There's this elite, wealthy group. And then there's the rest of us, right? The peasants, the slaves, the gangbangers, the drug dealers, and then crime. It's more, you're more incentivized to be a criminal than you are to be a productive member of society. So it just exponentially ratchets out. And then you end up with this weird, weird corrupt system where the elite oligarchs rule everything. And that's kind of how it was in El Salvador for the last 60 years, right? You had the very wealthy, rich people who didn't have to worry about much. And then you had the average person who lived in this living nightmare every day. Like, couldn't go out to get ice cream because it was too dangerous. You couldn't sit on your porch at night because it was too dangerous. You know, you didn't really have family gatherings or parties. If you did, I mean, it was, everybody was home by 4 p.m., you know, kind of thing, because it was just so dangerous and violent at night. It wasn't safe. Everybody was getting robbed and, you know, jumped, and you're pretty much, I don't want to say stop paying your taxes, but, you know, your taxes become the extortion that you pay to the cartel members, you know, and society just collapses in on itself. And I think that's what we're headed towards here in America. I think you're, with these AI data centers, I think they're going to bankrupt the middle class. I think they're going to devastate these neighborhoods and these communities. I think they're going to, you know, destroy all of the water and the resources. And then things are just going to get, you know, your water bill is going to double, your gas bill is going to double, your electricity bill is going to triple, right? And all these things are going to happen. And it just depletes your life savings. It just depletes your wealth, right? And if you can't keep up, most people live kind of like beyond their means here in America, where they might be getting by, they might be putting a little bit money into savings, but once that spending still continues as things exponentially go up, next thing you know, they're starting to take a little money out of savings every month. They're starting to tip into their 401ks. You just look and Google trends right now, how to file for bankruptcy at all-time high, how to cash out my 401k at all-time high, how to file for bankruptcy at all-time high, my car, behind on my car loan, how many car payments can I miss before my car is repossessed, all-time high, all-time high. Credit card debt at an all-time high. Credit card spending at an all-time high. Like all of these things are all of the writings on the walls. Like we don't know how bad this collapse is going to get. Some people say it's not going to collapse because the Fed's just going to keep printing and it's just going to exponentially, you know, like our inflation, the dollar's lost 25% of its value since Trump took office. I mean, we can't, something's got to break here in a very short period of time. And when it breaks, I just don't know how bad it's going to get.
Well, that's part of the reason, you know, I've considered moving to some of these other countries because, you know, when it does break, and I think it's a mathematical certainty, when it does break, they don't have as far to fall. I mean, I can buy a pupusa down there for a dollar. Yep. You know, I could eat all day long for under $5 yep. in a place like that. You know, it's in a place where food comes easily, you know, with what I do in farming and permaculture and all that stuff. You know, I'm being courted by a number of people down there that try to get on the first thing smoking because that's part of what they need down there. They need people like me that can grow food and teach others how to do it as well and do it, you know, efficiently and without drugs. No, I agree with you 1,000%, Ryan. I think we are definitely, I mean, people don't tell me this ain't, no, we got 900 military bases in 130 countries. That's an empire. So, Ryan, yeah, man, I got to have you back sometime, man, so we can get into more some of this. Man, I got a whole list of questions I wanted to ask you about that you are really – folks, if you want to know, I mean, this guy is all over everything, and you can check him out on X. But one of the big topics I would love to get into, but I just don't have time right now, is all the lies we're told about our greatest ally over there, you know, the one that the Pentagon just warned everybody about.
Let's do it, man. I could be here tomorrow whenever you say the word for that one. That's my favorite conversation to have. So, and we could go deep and dark. I mean, it'll blow your audience's mind when we start really exposing what this, you know, like just to sum it up in a short phrase, right? Like if you believe in Judaism, right? They believe that their Messiah is going to come back, right? Now their Messiah only comes back when the West falls. Okay. So whether it's the left wing or the right wing, it doesn't matter. The left wing promotes drag queen story hour and open borders and the LGBTQ agenda. And the right wing promotes the genocide and basically the slaughtering of innocent women and children out in the open. It doesn't matter which one that is. They're both working to the same goal. And it's to collapse society here, collapse civilization in America, because that's how their Messiah comes back. Now, what is their Messiah? Well, their Messiah is Satan, right? They literally worship Satan. And when you worship Satan, so when the Messiah comes back, he kills everybody and he only brings back the righteous Jews. Okay. And well, how do you become righteous in the eyes of Satan? Well, you defile everything that we consider holy. So as a Christian or as a Muslim, right, it is their sole purpose on life is to defile everything that we consider holy. And the more they do it, the more they become righteous in the eyes of their Lord and Savior. And then when he comes back, which is they're trying to bring down the West, and when the West falls, allegedly their Messiah is just going to pop back up and he's going to come over and kill everybody in the entire world. And he's going to bring back the righteous Jews. And they're each going to get like 1,000 Goyim slaves. We're considered Goyim. We're less than cattle. But it even gets darker and deeper than that. But that's kind of to sum it up, and I'll leave you on that cliffhanger for the next time that we go down that rabbit hole.
Oh, man, you definitely – I think there's a whole lot of people right now just freaking out still about what you discussed regarding the child trafficking and how it's being done by our government, folks. I mean, this is – we – when the history books are written, I don't think people are even going to believe that it could be this corrupt and this depraved. So, Ryan, where does everybody –
and who's our government ran by? Right. It's all controlled by Israel. It's all. And so who is to blame for the trafficking of the children? Who's to blame for our government not going and rescuing the children? Who's to blame for our open borders? Right. Like all signs always roll. It doesn't matter what rabbit hole I dig down. If I dig down deep enough, I find a rabbi. That's why I just call them rabbi holes at this point, because like that's just what they are. It's like every dark, demonic, evil, vile rabbit hole that I dig down, at the end of it, I find a rabbi and all roads lead back to Tel Aviv. And it's just like at some point, man, I don't know what. When or how much longer are we going to take it? But it feels like there's like been this demonic spell. Like they can harness this dark energy. They're behind the abortions. They're behind the LGBTQ agenda. They're behind the transgender mutilation of our children, right? They're behind, 30 or 40% of our women under the age of 30 Consider their primary source of income is OnlyFans. They're turning our entire country and all of our women into prostitutes. They're behind all of it. And somehow they're acquiring this dark demonic energy, which we can break this down more in the next discussion. Don't understand how they're doing it, but it's almost like something is changing. I don't know if it's the religious revival and everybody's starting to pray more or waking up, but it's like the spell is being released and all of us are starting to see this for the first time. We're all going, wait, what the fuck is really going on here? No, I can't explain it. I can't, but we can all feel like the human body is more powerful. Our minds are more powerful than we've been led on to believe. We don't know why they want to inject our children at the day they're born with these vaccines that contain metals. We're learning that everything's made out of vibrations and frequencies, right? And the worst thing you could do for a frequency of a human body would be to inject metals like aluminum into it, right? And prevent that vibrational frequency from taking place. Like, we don't really understand it, but something's weird's happening. And I think there's this big, great awakening that's taking place. And I think that there's going to be a more that we learn about the human bodies than we've ever known or ever thought possible.
Well, I'm definitely down that road. And like you said, man, there's so much more to cover, but we got to have you back. Ryan, where does everybody find you?
You can go find me at Ryan Matta or at Shots by Matta on Instagram. It's Ryan Matta on everything, or Ryan Matta this, or Ryan Matta that. I've been demonetized, deplatformed. It's hard to keep the same username, but you should search Ryan Matta for the most part, and you'll see me.
Well, folks, I mean, he definitely brings it. And folks, you haven't even heard a fraction of what else he's going to bring. So we'll definitely have to do a part two sometime very soon. Up to my eyeballs with a number of things right now, but I want to thank Ryan. I want to thank all of you out there for checking us out. Until next time, stay alert. Stay alive.
From the smallest sprout to the harmony begin in the cycle of life, for the magic's alive. Tune it to the beat, feel the vibe and thrive.
Why have we asked our contractor we found on Angie.com to be our kid's legal guardian? Because he took such good care when redoing our basement that we knew we could trust him to care for our kids, all 8 of them, should something happen to us.
Are you my dad now?
No, sorry, I do basements.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
This is Danielle Fishel.
And Ryder Strong from Pod Meets World.
When you have 5 and 7-year-old boys, I can promise you they love superheroes.
Oh, it never goes away. Indy is 11 years old and he's obsessed with comics, cartoons, video games, all of it.
Adler and Keaton both have Spider-Man costumes, and if anything says Marvel on it, they are in.
Same. Which is why we love Lingo Kids. They have Marvel Spider-Man activities that are totally age appropriate.
And safe. Made just for the little ones.
Plus, Disney's Moana, Frozen, Zootopia, all the characters your kids already love, and a few you're secretly hoping they'll get into.
I just load up the iPads with Lingo Kids before a trip, and with over 4,000 interactive activities, songs, and shows, it keeps their attention for hours.
Download Lingo Kids for free or go all in with Lingo Kids Plus for even more incredible content.
Choose the yearly plan and save up to 60%. Search Lingo Kids in the App Store or Google Play.
Lingo Kids, everything kids love.
Treat Dad this Father's Day with great gifts from Menards. From levels, nailers, and drills to complete any project, to tool chests, recliners, and grills, we've got the perfect gifts to make this Father's Day one to remember. Stop by your local Menards today and save big money on gifts for Dad. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save